Welcome to Two's Talk with Tosh, Dino, and Donnie.
Today we have a very special guest, Mark Smith, who is the high performance director and the head coach of the women's national teams with us. We're going to get into a lot of his coaching experience, some of his playing experience, and have a little round table with some minds, some brilliant minds in the ball world. So welcome, Mark.
Hey, thank you, Donnie. It's nice to be here.
So, Mark, introduction aside, you have a fantastic title, a great position. I think a position that is we're pretty envious of, for sure. I want to get into, if it's okay with you, to start, from Nova Scotia.
Born and raised.
Good, and you're there now?
I am.
Good for you. Just a little bit about your background playing-wise, obviously, 9 ISCs, 2 titles, 4 golds at the Pan Am Games, a pretty impressive resume. The thing I want to start with, though, a bit of a curveball, probably should have asked you offline, but you had a tryout with KC, a baseball tryout, correct?
I did.
82.
Ooh,
and the
that's
one,
news to I me, did. Too.
Yeah, well, hey, guys, research.
Donnie did your homework.
Well, the thing that sorry to interrupt, Mark. The thing that I wanted to get across is on another edition, we kind of talked offline about I've never hit a baseball in my life, and Dean said the same thing. And I want you to talk about the experience, but I also want you to talk about the difference in hitting a tiny ball from 20 feet farther back as opposed to hitting the fastball. So, if you could, yeah, please, the floor is yours.
Well, the opportunity came about really quite. By accident, I guess I would say. I was at the ISC in Saginaw, Michigan in 81, which was the first year I had gone, and our team was successful there. And someone who was connected to the Royals was at that event and happened to see me pitch and passed it along to the Royals organization. And lo and behold, I was home here in the fall of that year, and I got a phone call from a guy named Dick Balderson, who at that time was sort of the director of player personnel or something to that extent. And I thought it was actually a teammate from Camarillo that was a bit of a prankster and do impressions. And so needless to say, this guy calls and tells me who he is, and he sounds exactly like this old teammate. And I'm not buying it for one second. I figure I'm getting pranked here. And so I'm really giving this guy a hard time, and I end up hanging up on him.
Did you give him the Jake Taylor from Major League? Is that you, Tolbert? This isn't very funny, you know.
Yeah.
And then about 10 minutes later, the phone rings again at my parents' house, and he says, "No, seriously, I am who I say I am. I'm not whoever you thought I was." And so the conversation sort of went from there. And they invited me to spring training in 82. And I originally accepted that I would go. It was, to me, I had played baseball until I was about 15, so I wasn't completely unfamiliar with baseball, but had played at a rep level in Nova Scotia, but I certainly never saw myself as going anywhere with baseball. But just when I was supposed to leave to go to camp, my grandmother passed, and I was in California at the time, and I called him and said, I can't come. My grandmother's passed, grew up pretty close to my grandmother, and I just felt coming home was the right thing to do. So I did. I packed up and came home to spend some time with family, and got back to California about 2 weeks later, and I got a call from him again saying, "Look, if you're still interested, we'd still like to have you come." So spoke to the owner of the team I was playing for in California. He agreed that I could go, and so I flew to Sarasota, and I spent about, 8 or 9 days there. And what they were thinking was that at the time there was a submarine-style pitcher on their big team named Dan Quisenberry, and he threw unorthodox slingshot sort of release. And they were thinking that maybe I could do something like that, given I threw under him. But found that to be really awkward. So I stuck with trying to throw conventionally. And I think on their gun, I got it to about maybe mid-80s to, 88, 89. That was probably about the best I could do. But, I wasn't under contract. And you're kind of more like a guinea pig than anything. The players thought it was a bit of an anomaly having this guy here that was a softball player. And I would throw the softball underhand to practice when I wasn't throwing the baseball, and they got a kick out of that. But it lasted 8 or 9 days, and I just realized that there wasn't any type of real opportunity offered. When I looked at my situation in softball, having had it at that point, I had attended one Pan Am Games. I had been to one ISC, had a pretty good situation in California with a pretty good team and a sport that I was confident and comfortable with and an environment I knew well. And I just didn't see the baseball at that point offering me quite the same opportunity. And so I made the choice to pack it up and go back to Camarillo and play in California.
That's too bad, Smitty, because you could have been, like, Dan Quisenberry was a big star on SNK Baseball Stars. We always bring SNK Baseball Stars into this. It's our video game that we played growing up. I would have loved to have had Mark Smith throwing from the left side.
Amazing.
On that staff.
So before Moneyball.
The funny thing, Dino, was guys like Mark Gubazon and Danny Jackson, who eventually went on to be, you know, household names with the Royals for a period of time in the mid to late 80s, they were at this camp, and none of them were, you know, at that, to me anyway, they didn't appear to be exceptionally talented. I mean, they very clearly could throw the baseball and they could make the ball spin and all the things we could do with it underhand. But I thought, you know, watching them, I didn't come away thinking, holy cow, that guy is there's a major leaguer for sure. And then 4 or 5 years later, you turn the television on and there's a couple of guys that you were sitting in a clubhouse with or sitting on the bench with. So it was kind of neat that way. But and I'm grateful for the experience, but I don't regret making the decision to go back to softball. It was the right thing for me to do, and I'm glad I did it.
Well, one, looking at your resume, would argue that it worked out pretty well for you on the softball side. So before the Moneyball A's, there was Mark Smith and the Royals trying to get a look at a different angle. That's fantastic. Do you have a
very cool?
Who do you have a story that sticks out the most in those 9 days in spring training? Or and the other question I have is, who was the best hitter that you saw there?
I think the story that would stick out, and I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a first round draft pick out of high school. He was a pitcher, right-handed guy, probably about 6'3", 6'4", and had been in the Chicago White Sox organization. And after a couple of years, they kind of gave up on him. But back then, you know, if you were getting $150,000, $200,000 to sign, that was considered to be pretty big money. So this guy had signed for whatever the max was as a high school kid, and didn't do well with the White Sox. So apparently they released him outright after a couple of years, and then the Royals decided that the White Sox hadn't done it properly. They were gonna sign this kid, and they gave him a boatload of money. So here he is in camp, and you know this is the rave. I don't even remember his name. This is the rave that he's this kid that's now got about $500,000 in the bank, and he's never played a day of double A ball. So I'm watching him pitch, and, you know, he's doing his thing, and the coaches are with him and that sort of thing. And at the time, because I was there to pitch, they didn't let me bat. And I said, well, you know, I can hit, you know. And it was like, oh, yeah, whatever. You know, you're here to pitch. But anyway, I eventually talked them into giving me a swing. And, of course, lo and behold, who would the swing end up being against was this kid. And about the third pitch in, I hit one out of the yard. And
so that's
my claim to fame. And, yeah, you know, I felt pretty good about that and got on a plane 2 days later, went back to California. But that was sort of the highlight of my experience, to go in there and actually have a bat in a situation that was somewhat competitive and do okay with it. The other thing that stood out for me was just how competitive the environment was. I remember walking into the clubhouse one day, and there was an older black gentleman who was the clubhouse attendant, and you know that's where you get your jersey and you get your pants and you get your jacket or whatever they were giving you. And there were these two guys that were about ready to square off, and they were Latin American players, and they were getting at it pretty good verbally before people got in. And I was one of the last to leave the clubhouse, so I said something to the old guy about, you know, what was that all about. And he basically told me what we eventually have come to hear quite a bit in terms of the Latin players, and that because it's so competitive where they come from, and baseball, it was the ticket to get them off the island or wherever they might have lived, that it really was life or death with these guys. And this happened to be a couple of middle infielders who were vying for the same position, and you know, neither one of them was given an inch. So those are probably the two things during the time I was there that stood out.
Do you ever think, and this is morbid to think about, but did you ever think that one home run swing you took off this prospect ended his career? And they looked at him and said, oh my God, this guy's done. Well,
frickin' softball player.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, you did leave spring training with a bomb. That's impressive. That's more than I can say. I can barely hit a bomb
cool.
in a fastball.
Very cool. Yeah.
So the last question was, Who was the best hitter other than yourself? Obviously, one for one with a bomb. That's a pretty good stat line. Was there a hitter there that stood out in your mind?
There was a guy they actually roomed me with because I showed up at camp late. I kind of went right up to the AA, AAA crowd, and they had, it was dormitory style housing, but they put me in a room with a guy named Michael Brewer who had been to AAA, and he was a guy that I think they thought had, you know, pretty good shot at making the big team. So he and I kind of had this suite, which was pretty cool. And I really didn't know who he was, but, you know, I got to know him over that period of time, and he seemed like a pretty good guy. And what really impressed me was he had his own Hillrich and Bradsby baseball bat with his name on his bat. So that usually meant you were somebody back then if you had your own bat. And, you know, I tried to kind of follow things along after I left there, and he never did make it, or he never did make the Royals team. But, you know, he was about 6'4", 6'5", athletic, quick, played the outfield. And he certainly looked just, without even putting a, you know, a bat over his shoulder, he looked like a specimen. And he was a guy that you would have thought just by looking at him that had every opportunity to make it there, but unfortunately didn't.
Did you have any encounters with George Brett while you were there?
They were long gone. They were long gone by the time I got there.
That's too bad because
big guys go.
I've heard he's a legendary spring training joke prank, like a prankster. So I would have loved to hear if he had pulled any pranks on the softball guy coming in.
I'll tell you what they did though. That was funny at the time was, you know, snakes in Florida are pretty prevalent, and I was in the. Actually, it was during the NCAA finals because it was the night that I'm thinking of was the night that North Carolina won the title when Sleepy Floyd handed the ball off to the guy on the wrong team and they went down the other end and scored. I think he handed it off to James Worthy. But anyway, I was sitting in the dorm watching the game with the guys, and there was a bunch of guys that went outside, and all of a sudden there was a commotion, and I came outside, and there was what looked to be a rubber snake kind of curled up to look like a rattlesnake, and it was a pretty good sized snake sitting on the ground just in front of the door I was coming out of. And I guess the prank was that somebody had said that it was a rubber snake, but it was in fact a real snake, and one of the guys had kind of knocked, guy who was quite comfortable picking up snakes, had knocked this thing or stunned it. And of course I come walking down off the step, and all of a sudden the snake moves, and I just about jumped into somebody's arms, and I got a pretty good kick out of that.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I would have passed out for sure. Not a snake fan, for sure.
No.
Wow. That's incredible. So now I guess I want to ask you, having seen, you know, hitting from the baseball perspective and obviously a great career hitting in fastball, can you tell us a little bit about the difference between the two?
I think hitting a fastball is more difficult because of the fact that the strike zone is larger, because you can throw the ball to the top of the zone and the bottom of the zone. And not that you can't with baseball as well, but because the arc of the ball tends to be coming down, you really do have a smaller area to cover, unless you're undisciplined at the plate, which certainly can happen as well. But if you are somewhat disciplined, the strike zone's just so much smaller. And I even found that to be true when we would play games in the United States in fastball, that compared to the Canadian strike zone, which literally some days seem to be from just under your chin to just above your shoelaces, you know, in the United States, there were pitches that would have been navel high just above your belt that are being called a ball, which are pitches in Canada that we would have been more than happy to swing at. So I thought the U.S. zone was smaller, which meant it made it tougher for pitchers and better for hitters. But as far as hitting the baseball, when I, you know, having played baseball prior to this experience, I was somewhat familiar with, you know, with baseball and having, you know, swung at many baseballs. And I felt that fast pitch, when you got to the top end of fast pitch and you faced, you know, the guys like Dino and guys like threw the ball hard and threw the ball up in the zone, Peter Meredith, people like that. I never faced a Nolan Ryan, but I can't imagine that he was any tougher to hit than Peter Meredith.
That's exactly.
That's crazy to think about. I guess for comparison's sake, you know, the top guys like the Dinos and that throw, you know, mid 80s up to 90.
Who's this Dino that you talk of?
It's you, bud. It's okay.
And how is he in the same sense as Peter Meredith? Wow, thanks, fellas. Well, okay, thanks for having you on, Smitty. We'll talk to you later.
Yeah. If you two want to go off mic and have a fight, I get it. I understand it. Let us know when you're done. But, okay, so I'm saying like Dino, like, you know, Folkard now, like those guys that hit the Pat Burns, that hit the high 80s. and they can make the ball go up and down. And then the big thing for me, obviously, is the changeup can be 40. So it's a half-speed pitch as opposed to in baseball. If they're throwing 90, 92, 93, their changeup's 88 or 80, 87. So the difference is not nearly as dramatic. I guess my question to you is, comparatively speaking, to the top-end hit pitchers that you would have faced, to what would you say the speed comparison would be up to a baseball?
Oh, jeez.
I realize it's not an exact science.
That's a tough question, yeah.
It is. So take your time.
When you say speed comparison, you mean...
reaction time?
The high end velocity. Yeah, exactly. High end velocity versus difference. That is a difficult question to answer. I guess what I would simply say is I always felt like you could see the baseball better. And maybe it's because you were looking down at it. And, you know, your eyes didn't have you didn't have to worry about the zone being expanded quite the same way. A ball coming out of a baseball pitcher's hand that was high was going to stay high. You know, it was a ball from his hand. Whereas in softball, a guy can let the ball go. You know, every pitch is being let go just below the waist. You've got decisions to make within tenths of seconds and hundreds of seconds as to whether or not you're going to swing or not swing. Whereas I thought with baseball, you just had a little bit more time to see it and react to it. Now, I'm saying that not having played Major League Baseball, but yet having faced the equivalent of that in softball. So it's a bit of an unfair comparison. But I always thought in general you saw the baseball longer. And one of the things that a couple of guys that I played men's fast pitch here with the Nova Scotia that were considered to be pretty good ball players, after they finished playing fast pitch, they went and played a couple of years of intermediate baseball. And they just talked about, you know, being much better hitters in the baseball and how much longer they felt they got to see the ball before they had to commit to his pitch. So, you know, based on the conversations that I would have had with them, it would be consistent with my thoughts too, that you just, if you played the top end of men's fast pitch, hitting a baseball was an easier task.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to think so. We're pretty biased on this podcast, but I think that for sure is kind of the general rule. I've just never had the ability or the opportunity, I guess, to step in and face somebody that's throwing like that in overhand.
Well, think of some of those guys that have made that transition. Like, I mean, we all have guys that we played with that were either ex-baseball guys and they came on board. Todd Budke's, like, obviously, first and foremost, as far as guys that I played with that I know. But, I mean, he made that transition amazingly well. Most don't. You know, on the hitting side, trying to hit that rise ball, that was always a thing that you could try to throw by them, right? You knew they were a baseball guy.
That's a really good comparison because Jerry Willard Jr., who would not be a household name, but he was the backup catcher for the Atlanta Braves in the 1996 World Series. His father was the first base coach for the team I played for in Camarillo. And we had a league in Camarillo in the winter that started sort of mid-February and went till 1st of April before the Western Softball Congress started, which was the league we played out of. And it was one of these sort of local house leagues where a number of different businesses in the community sponsored teams, and our Camarillo team was split up and no more than two players could play on one of the league teams in the league, and you couldn't play your regular position. And it was more of a, you know, these sponsors all kicked in a couple of bucks, and it was kind of an opportunity to be part of the community. And so one day, Jerry Willard Jr., who was with the Braves, came out to play. He played in this league. And, you know, he hit the ball pretty well because it was pretty much intermediate caliber pitching. And so it just so ended up that for shits and giggles, I pitched against him, you know, Major League Baseball awesome. Player, you know, and he never hit a foul ball.
Yeah.
Like it was, and the other thing was that during the 1981 strike, if you remember, Bobby Gritch, who was with the Angels, and Davey Lopes, who was with the Dodgers, between the two of them, they played in the Congress, the Western Softball Congress that our team was a part of. I did not face them. But I was told by, and this story was pretty consistent, that between the two of them, they had 31 at-bats in the Congress that year during the baseball strike, and there was one hit between the two of them.
Oh, wow.
Right? And these guys were household names in Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. And Daryl Strawberry, one more story. I played in a Sunday morning league in L.A. down at a place called Crenshaw Park, which was part of the black community there, and you had a lot of former pro baseball players, pro football players, a lot of great athletes that went to Crenshaw High School, where Strawberry went to and came out of the area. People like Eric Davis and Chili Davis and a bunch of guys that had all gone on to have somewhat successful careers. And I played in this Sunday morning league, and it was sponsored by beer companies. And Strawberry and those guys wouldn't play. They wouldn't come out and play because they said, we got way too much to lose to be made a fool of by you guys.
So they would come.
I mean, they would come at the park. I knew Daryl and I had met Eric Davis. And they'd come out and they'd watch on Sunday morning. And, you know, they had family that were playing. Strawberry had two or three brothers that played on the team that I played on, which is how I got to know him. But they wouldn't pick up a batter or go anywhere near the plate. They said, not a chance.
Huh. Jesus, crazy.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a lose-lose situation.
Nothing to win. They got nothing to win here and everything to lose.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so,
very cool.
I mean, that's an awesome experience and cool story. I mean, your playing days, phenomenal resume. We could talk about that for a whole cast, but I really want to get into the coaching side of how you got involved. So you retired from playing in 98, correct?
I did.
Did you get into coaching right away, or was there a bit of a gap, or did you take some time off? And when you did get into it, how did the opportunity come up?
I actually started coaching around 1992, domestically, as a player coach for the senior team in Nova Scotia that I coached. I put together a senior team of a bunch of young kids that were just out of junior ball and you know, were full of piss and vinegar and wanted to play at a better level of fast pitch. And I did so primarily because when I moved home around 1986 and decided I was going to establish a career and play ball at home, the mindset of the senior ball players at that time was that everybody wanted to win the right to go to nationals for a week's vacation, to go here and not embarrass ourselves too badly. But no one ever had any designs on actually trying to win. As long as we were the best team from Atlantic Canada and we didn't get seven run by Ontario or BC or Saskatchewan, everybody was happy. And I just couldn't handle that. You know, I came from an environment where I was used to playing for pretty good teams and having an opportunity to compete and win, and to come home and be in this situation where winning the provincials was the thing that everybody lived for, so that we could go away for a week, the last week of August, and have fun and hopefully win a few ball games, just never sat well with me. So in 92, I was approached by one of the local beer manufacturers and asked if I, you know, would be interested in putting a team together. And I said that I, that I would. And I recruited a bunch of young kids and a few more senior guys that took the game fairly seriously. And we started, which was called the Halifax Keys program. And I coached that team from 93 through 96, and then took a year off in 97 to play more locally and help build another team towards the 98 Nationals, and then coached that team in 98 and played as well, and then we were lucky enough to win, and that was kind of the end of it for me. But I had been part of the NCCP and delivering coaching workshops as a player, as a lot of guys do that played our game at that time. You had that practical experience that you could bring to a clinic environment. And the coaching was more of a necessity. I was the most experienced player in the province. I had been coached by many good coaches from around the world, and it only made sense if I was going to play that I might as well coach as well. So I had that experience. And then after 94, I did a tour to New Zealand with the national team in the March of 94, and that was my last official national team experience as a player. And I had been invited the next year to come as a guest coach to a camp they were holding in Ontario, and so I did so. And then in 96, I was asked to go to the World Championships in Midland, Michigan as an assistant coach. So my coaching had sort of started about 7-8 years before I actually got out of the game as a player. So the transition was really simple for me. It gave me an opportunity to stay involved in the game, which I knew that I wanted to do. And quite honestly, to get away from the playing side of it was a relief, because you get to that stage where, you know, when you're coaching, especially if you're investing in learning how to become a better coach, then your own performance is what suffers, because when you're training for 2 or 3 hours, you are more focused on how you're helping other people get better, and that comes at the expense of you not putting in that time yourself. And I had reached that place where I just could no longer compete the way I wanted to as a player, and I found it frustrating. And fortunately enough, that when you win the national title, I was 39, I think, when we won, it was time to put the fiddle in the case and move on to the coaching piece. And that's what I did. And I was lucky enough to have the national team to fall back on. So even though I was giving up the playing side of it, I was stepping into coaching at, you know, arguably the best level in the game in the world. And I was really fortunate for that experience.
So you missed out on that making other people's careers that I've done for the last 15 years. You know, where you serve it up. Yeah. Hey, I'm sure I did 400 yards.
I'm sure I did a little of that too.
Good game.
Yeah. Well, I know. I think I had maybe one or you would have been with Dairy Queen. You and Jody, I think, came to Camrose that year, Smitty, in 91 for Nash.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think I had an at bat off you. I think it was a line drive up the middle. I can't remember for sure.
There you go.
You may remember differently.
You made Tosh's career.
I don't know, but yeah. And I'm gonna once you start.
I certainly remember talking. The first time I faced Dino. It would have been, I don't know if you remember this, Dino, but you came to Ottawa in.
Oh goodness!
I think it was like 92, 93. Yeah, with the Canada
Challenge
team.
Cup.
Tosh was
yep.
the second, but
that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and that's the first time we faced you guys, and I mean you beat us, I think, but. I remember seeing your guys' team and seeing you throw for the first time and thinking, there's a big, strong lad out there.
Little shit. Yeah. See, yeah. No, that was a lot of fun. Those are fun years. I mean, you know, a lot of great ball players, you know, just kind of whatever, just either at the end of their career or whatever. It was, you know, you always think back to the greats that you got the chance to play against, like Gino and, you know, even Batesy and, you know, some of the guys that you watch when you're growing up. And I'm not actually putting a screw to you here by saying you're that much older than me, because you're not, but, you know, just different eras and different timings and when people kind of came in and that sort of thing. It was pretty cool. I remember playing against you too, and it was a lot of fun.
I think it kind of, for me anyways, like you said, Dino, we kind of came in kind of at the tail end of there were some pretty good players. Like I got the chance to play against and with Colonel and against Tills, you know, so it was really cool because those are the guys we kind of, you know, we watched in Saskatoon, that, you know, with Ballomatics and whatever else. But the neat thing is we got to learn from those guys. I don't think it's, and Donnie, you're still playing senior A. I don't think it's the same. I don't think there's as many guys still playing that were probably at the, you know, at the top of the game that are kind of trickling down. Whereas I think our era was awesome for that, because we got in at the right time to see and still play against, you know, yourself and, you know, Gino broke my bat in half. Like, I mean, you know, he broke a lot of bats in half. But, I mean, it was an opportunity to see that. And I don't know if it's still there. As it was.
I think we all know the game's not nearly as healthy as it once was. I mean, you talk about feeling fortunate. I mean, I was lucky enough to start senior in 79 with Victoria, who were the five-time national champions and reigning world champions. And you know, we played in a league in the Northwest League where Seattle was the U.S. national champion and Victoria was the Canadian champion. So you had the two champions of both countries playing in the same league, and, you know, a 36-game schedule and a lot of other teams and good competition. And, you know, you both would have played in the West, so you know the quality of teams that would like to come out to the coast and play. So, you know, I was lucky enough to play with Bobby Burrows and Harvey Stevenson and Robbie Ginter you know, and the list goes on, and against, you know, Gino and the better players of the day. But the difference, I think, was as a youngster, I was in Victoria at 19, you were kind of growing up around the greats of the game. So when you would go to a tournament, when you weren't playing, you were sitting and watching how these great players from other teams played the game. And, you know, over time, when we look at how the men's game has died and how few teams there are now, and the fact that, you know, you used to be able to go to a tournament in Saskatchewan or in Alberta or in Winnipeg, and you would have the best teams from Western Canada playing every weekend.
Yeah.
And now you have to fly halfway around the world to find a decent game of ball, and you might only get to do that for 3 weekends a summer. So, you know, the young players have lost the history of the game because there is nobody to watch playing. Because they're gone, and because the teams are so spread out that, you know, the better, you know, you're a guy that grew up in Saskatoon, but you've got to fly to Madison, Wisconsin to find a good game of ball. So how do the kids locally get to watch you play when you've got to leave your home province every weekend to play we in a place where you're going to be challenged and be challenged to improve and be better? And I think that's the thing that's killed our game, is that kids no longer, I mean, there's lots of reasons for it in terms of technology and the way the world is today, but I just think that kids no longer got to come and hang around the ballpark and
pick and
want to emulate and be like the guy they watched out there playing, because we're not out there anymore playing.
True. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true.
You make a good point. Sorry, Tosh. I guess in our men's side now, there's two teams in Alberta, and, you know, 20 years ago, you couldn't go to a town that didn't have a good ball team. You could go 15 minutes up the road and have a good game. We have to play. We have to go to BC. We have to go to Kelowna, and then, like, our schedule this year was supposed to be, you know, Kelowna, Boys of Summer, ISCs, Nationals, to get five good tournaments, and you had to put on, you know, 10,000 miles. In the old, I won't say the old days, but in the glory days, you could have a home tournament. You could go to Edmonton. You could go to Saskatoon, stay pretty local and see, and all these teams just went there. There was enough good competition for teams to want to be in these tournaments. So for us now, we see the same seven teams 15 times a summer. It gets to be, like a little variety. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is much different.
Yeah. When I played in what was then, I guess, sort of the Western Major League, you had Manitoba through Alberta. There were no BC teams that came, but then you'd go across the Rockies and you could play another dozen teams in BC.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just not, it's a shame. I mean, that was in the heydays of the game, but it's just become so expensive. And of course, sponsorships. I mean, we started at a time when, you know, a sponsor might have spent $10,000 or $15,000 to have a team. Well, now $10,000 or $15,000 gets you a second baseman. It's just no comparison.
Not this
and,
one.
And a second baseman isn't even close to what a pitcher is, right?
No.
Oh, geez. Let's here talk we go. About that. Yeah,
hey,
here we
before
go.
Before we get going, I want to obviously we're going to talk about the women's side of the game with Smitty too. But I got one question that goes back, and I think I've asked you this a while ago. I think it was right around the time I was actually still trying out with the national team, and Smitty, you were coaching. You got to keep in mind that there's, as stories go, and over the years they get a little bigger and a little bigger, but do you recall Darwin Holine? Do you know who Darwin was? Cousin of mine, first cousin, threw the ball pretty hard.
Okay.
And it's okay to say no, but I think when I go a little further with the story, you might remember him. Unless, of course, this story is completely fabricated, which we're going to find out pretty soon.
Yeah, you should
We are. We're going to go right to it here.
Okay.
So Darwin threw hard enough, but we love Darwin. He's awesome for our family. He's just he's our kind of our go-to. And so Darwin threw the ball a lot, like a lot of the Holines did back in the day. And he threw the ball pretty hard. And he said, back in the day, he got picked up to play with, and I don't know the team, but they ended up playing you guys. And it was right before, it was like a tune-up where you were going somewhere. It was either a big national or ISF or something like that. And you got hit in the wrist. He hit you. He dotted you. Do you remember that?
Well, you know what? Yeah, well, I got hit. I got hit, and I didn't know if it was him or not, but I got hit early in the year, actually. It was just before, it was just after coming back from the tryouts for the 83 Pan Am team.
It was big.
It
I know.
It ended up busting a finger. I think I busted two fingers. I remember being hit. Maybe he was the guy that did it. I didn't remember who
tall,
did it. I certainly
tall,
remember
redheaded fella, and he usually said, "Look out!" right before it hit you. He was a really nice guy.
God.
So yeah,
I knew that. Sorry, Smitty, I should have warned you. I knew that story was coming. He's been living on that for I don't know how long. So I got a question for you. So you've gone the transition for a lot of players, and Dino and I and Donnie kind of same boat where you make that transition. What was the biggest, and I don't know if it was a hurdle or the easiest, what was the couple things maybe that you really had to pay attention to, or you really noticed when you made the transition from top level player to top level coach? Because I mean, not many guys girls even have that ability to go right into where you went. I mean, you were one of the top players in the country, and then you end up coaching with the national team, like boom, boom, right? There's that growing period. But what are some of the things that you remember about that transition?
I think, to be really truthful about that, Tosh, you know, because I started coaching in '93 in a head coach capacity, I got to make an awful lot of mistakes between 93 and 98 before I actually got to coach internet. And I say that because, you know, I remember, never forget my wife. I tell this story to my wife, teaches a coaching class, and I've told this story every year now for, I think, 20 years. But, you know, I think as a high-level player, and you guys can you know, chip into this if you agree, there's always the fear, and you don't realize it at the time because you're thinking like a player who coaches. And then eventually, hopefully, you become a coach that played. But my biggest fault, and I had lots of them, but probably the one that I would say was the biggest one, and early on, was that I judged everybody by my work ethic. Mm-hmm. And I worked hard at the game. I worked hard to be a world-class pitcher. It was important to me to do so. I was the kid that, you know, I remember people, you know, reminding me of it. But, you know, in the middle of summer when other kids were on the bikes and off doing things, I was up throwing a ball off a chain link fence, you know, in the afternoon of a hot summer day because I was pitching when everybody else was out doing other stuff. And I did it because I loved it and I wanted to be there. So, you know, as a ball player, to me, it was always about how do I get better? What's the next thing I need to do? You know, no matter how good I was today, I still want to be better tomorrow. And what I found when I started to take on the coaching role was that the work ethics weren't what I thought they should be. And guys weren't, they weren't taking poor performances personally enough. And it didn't seem to matter to some guys whether they played well or played poorly. It was still, everybody stayed for beers afterwards and had a yuck. And whereas if I played poorly or didn't pitch well, I wanted to get in the car and go home because I was annoyed and I needed to kind of process and work through it. And my wife said to me one day on the way home from a game, we had not won, we had not played well, the team hadn't played well, and I was in my venting mode driving home. And she just turned to me and she goes, you know, if you keep this up, you will not have any friends. Like, you are complaining about all of these things, and maybe they're true and maybe they're not, but since you're the coach, how about if you teach them the things you claim they don't need to do and stop bitching about it? Mm-hmm. And, so it was a quiet ride from that point forward.
She's working. Yeah.
But the bottom line was she made a very valid point. Like, you're the coach. These kids are, you know, you're the leader. They're going to follow your cue. Rather than criticizing what they can't do, then start figuring out how you're going to teach them what they need to know. And it was a really good, it was a great point that she made, and it really changed my perspective on what I needed to do better as a coach. So I think the hardest thing for me was to eventually accept that stop complaining, figure out how you're going to teach it to them and invest in that, your energies in that, as opposed to criticizing what's not happening. When I got to the international level, the hardest thing for me initially was I had played with a lot of the guys that were still part of that team when I was an assistant. And as you guys well know, when you've been teammates with somebody, it doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter what the title is they hold, you always see them in a different light, which is the light as being a teammate and a buddy and, you know, and having a beer and doing whatever the case. And I found it really difficult to, I won't say be taken seriously, but, you know, you're trying to have a conversation with a guy like Brian Patton, who, you know, we played together on the 92 Worlds team, or, you know, or Marty, who was a good personal buddy. I mean, he didn't play on, he wasn't still playing at that time, but there were some players that were still kicking around that I had played a summer or two with on the national team, and trying to transition from Mark the teammate, Mark the buddy, to Mark the coach was a challenge. And I'm glad I got to go through it because I think I was better for it. But I think there were a lot of things that I, you know, if I could do it over again, I would have invested more time in trying to learn how to do some things differently. Even when I became head coach and a lot of those guys had left, and some of them, I believe at the time, had reached a place in their playing careers where they were no longer capable of competing. But, you know, in some cases, should I have allowed them to come out to a tryout camp and let them fight for the spot they had, as opposed to simply calling people and saying we're going to go in a different direction? I still think about some of those things and some of those relationships that ended poorly because I was very decisive about the direction I wanted things to go in. Was I right? Was I wrong? I don't know. But I think back to, you know, how would I have done some things differently or handled them differently? For sure I would have. And I think that just comes with maturing and experience and recognizing that at the time, you know, we all do the best we can with what we have. And you make the decisions that make the most sense to you at that time. But, you know, recognizing that you can't judge people by your own standards because most of the time they're going to always come up a little short, and learning how to
coach people that you may be close to in age or have, you know, had similar experiences with as a player. That was something too that was, you know, I don't know that there is a way to learn to do it other than if Terry Bader had previously played on the national team, maybe I could have learned it from him. But I didn't really have a role model in that sense that could help me navigate that piece of the coaching, because the people that I played for on the national team had never played the game at this level. So that was not an insight they could share.
Well, you just laid the carpet down for this next one, because that was one of the things as a player. You know, I kind of came in at the end of the Terry Bader era, and that was one of the things that was talked about. I mean, you were there as an assistant, but Bugsy was still there, and, you know, some guys that, you know, hadn't played. And as a young guy, it didn't really, I didn't seem to make a difference to me. It was just, he's the coach, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But I will remember, though, when the staff rolled over and you became the head coach, and walking into a team meeting, and there's you and Colonel and Tilly at the front of the room, that whole coaching staff took on a whole different, there was just this, oh my God, mm-hmm. You know, like you look at the three guys in the front of this room and then you look at yourself and go, I don't even think I should be here. Right, like these guys are awesome. Right, what am
you,
I?
You
doing?
Probably shouldn't have, Tosh.
but you know what I mean. And I think that was, you know, and maybe going from the transition from the guys' team to the girls' game, and maybe this is a good transition. But I look at what you did by bringing on former national team players that have been there, done that, and it just, I guess the word is credibility, that automatically brought that to the table, and.
I think there's a bias. I mean, one of the things I look back, and I'm a bit of an analytical soul, you know, I guess, as I age, and, you know, one of the things that I at the time I believed in a great deal was that you want people that have kind of had the lived experience. You know, we played for Terry Bader, and Terry, I thought, was a very good tactical coach. I don't know that Terry's greatest strength was teaching skills. I mean, he never spent a lot of time doing that. And I also think that Terry was fortunate enough to come along at a time, I kind of compare it to Scotty Bowman in the heydays with the Habs, where, mm-hmm. you know, it didn't matter which 17 you picked, you were probably going to play in a gold medal game because yeah. there was a lot of talent to go around. And so, you know, but I felt when I was lucky enough to be named the head coach that it would be important to surround players with guys that had walked in their shoes and that could bring the lived experience and could share on the basis of having, you know, look down the barrel of, you know, somebody out there throwing at 90 miles an hour with a runner on second and you're down two runs. I mean, you can't fake experience. And what Marty and Ray brought was the experience piece of it. And then Dog came in and, you know, although Donnie didn't play on the national team, he played at a high enough level to have an appreciation for what it took to compete at that level. And so my goal was to surround the players with people who had been there and done that and could bring great insights, and hope that we could develop the communication skills and the teaching skills to help make people better. And, you know, I think we did okay. It had a game, like anything, you look at it and you think there's things you would have done differently. But that, to me, was important. And I remember the first camp that I ran as the head coach when we were in Victoria. And that was sort of the first thing that I wanted to establish for players, was that you're now going to be among people who have, we're not going to ask you to do anything we haven't done ourselves. And there's very little that's going to happen on a ball field that we haven't experienced, good or bad. So you're at least surrounded by people that can be of support to you in those respects.
Yeah, I totally agree. So, we'll, you know, the whole national team with the men's side, and we'll kind of fast forward here to 2013 and 2009, and where you're kind of doing double duty, and we won't talk much about Saskatoon because I still wake up screaming most nights. But I know that you were in a really tough spot there, and a lot of people maybe don't know that you were coaching both national teams at the same time, pretty much. And you know, how did that come about, and then what was the final decision to move on to the women's program?
Well, it came about because at the end of the 2008 Olympics, Lori Sipple, who had been the head coach of the women's program, was still an associate head coach in Nebraska and had made known to Softball Canada that at the conclusion of the Olympics, she would be returning to Nebraska. The team didn't have as successful an Olympics as they would have liked and really were in a bit of a state of flux. They didn't know who would retire. They didn't know who would come back. They weren't sure how well the team would do, quite honestly, in 2009, which was a qualification year for the 2010 World Championships and the 2011 Pan Am Games. So the organization did not want to go out on a limb and make a commitment to a coach over a four-year cycle when they weren't sure that in 2009 the team would perform well enough to earn a berth in those two major events. So Harvey Stevenson, as you both know well, was the general manager for national teams and approached me probably in December of 2008 and said there's going to be, you know, an opportunity with the women's team because it's looking like they want to look for a short-term fix as opposed to a long-term fix. You know, he and I had talked about it. I had been to a couple of women's camps when Lori was the head coach and had been around it and also had spent some time with Ken Erickson for about a 10-year period working at his camps in South Florida with NCAA players. So I was somewhat familiar with the women's game, having not coached in it, but being around female players and understanding a little bit around how they think and that sort of thing. So long story short, when Harvey asked about it, I talked to my wife, I talked to my employer. They agreed, you know, if I put my hat in the ring and if I were successful, and I was successful, and that meant basically I needed about a 10-week leave of absence from my job at Sport Nova Scotia, which they gave to me. And, you know, it was probably the best professional development experience I've ever had in my life, the hopping back between the two, because the cultures are so different. And with the women's team, they were in a state of you know, despair. There wasn't a great chemistry. They really didn't have a lot of confidence in themselves. There was very clearly some issues around teammates not trusting and respecting one another. So, you know, I got to go into an environment where I really could start to help with that healing process and figure out, you know, who did we need versus who didn't we need, and the challenge of trying to cobble together a team that can be competitive from a group of players that really didn't respect one another a great deal and want to play as a team. And it certainly consumed a lot of energy in trying to get them there, but I saw it as a challenge I was up for. And with the 2009 men's team, you know, we were a very good team. And I felt, to be honest with you, that if the World Championships had been played when they were supposed to be in 2008, I felt we would have been world champions.
Yeah.
Because that year, everybody under the sun that was Canadian at the ISC was firing on all cylinders. And mm-hmm. and if that group could have played a year earlier, I don't think anybody could have beaten us. And I still think the group we had in 2009 was a pretty darn good group too. But the hopping back and forth was a real interesting experience for me in sort of, you know, sociology of learning how to deal with people, of understanding the differences between how males process and females process. And
my wife, you know, teaches me that all the time.
And so it was a great experience, you know, and I'm grateful that I had it. The women's team did qualify, which was great. We, of course, came up a little short of what we had hoped in Saskatoon, but nonetheless, we put on a pretty good show and I thought worked really hard and played really well. And when it was all over with, what I had said or asked of Softball Canada was, you know, I knew I still wanted to continue coaching. By 2009, you know, I had started with the men's team in 1983. So between playing and coaching, I'd had a pretty good run. And I felt like, you know what, it's probably time that these men had another voice, that they heard somebody else that could take it in a different direction. You know, there is a point in time, I think, to where you do get to where something has to give or something has to change. A great number of the players that were part of that 2009 team or the core of that team were going to retire. Or retire from the national program, and I felt this is probably the right time for me to exit as well. And so the deal was that I would get to make a choice after 2009, and I thought the women's team was going to be a new challenge, and I really did feel like there was the potential there to do something with them and kind of get them back to a place of being creditable and respectable at that, you know, on the women's side of the game. And so I saw it as a neat opportunity to take on, and fortunately for me, it's worked out and I'm still there.
Right on. Very cool. So we're now fast forward. You've been with the women's program now for a whole bunch of years. 11? You know, there's 12. 12, yeah. I'm not very good at math.
Apparently, we haven't even
touch the lady side yet, Tasha. There is no way we get. Here's the good news: we get to have Smitty come back, right? Because you can't go back and go over however long we've been chatting over all the men's and the guy side of the game. We haven't even touched the lady side yet, so I can't even imagine that's going to be a like
we. You kind of put Mark on the spot there.
Well, I guess an invitation.
I fully agree. I fully agree. I would love to do it again. The women's game is a very interesting experience, as I'm sure you both are learning with your endeavors with your 222s
you
program.
Bet.
I think it's, in terms of, I talked about the PD piece, I learn from these women every day. I think they keep you young. I think they keep you current. I think they challenge your thinking. They're willing to work hard, but they want to understand why they're working hard and what's expected of them. And they've made me a better coach, like 100% better coach, better communicator. And again, I'm grateful for the opportunity, but I've learned a great deal. And to Dino's point, we could spend another hour talking about that environment and how you create the right environment to be successful with the female group.
Well, with that being said, can we have you for another hour? I mean, we're in a world of firsts here on this podcast. We could have our very first two-part podcast.
Yeah, we could.
And I'm not closing the door on a trilogy, to be quite honest. You can become a regular if you like, whatever your schedule will allow. But I agree there is so much to go over, and there's so much information, and I've just been sitting here with my jaw on the desk thinking, oh my God, think of the minds, not mine, I'm the mediator, but the minds on this podcast and the things they've seen and now that they're applying to coaching. There's so much to go over. I'd love to be able to pick your brain on the other side of the game on another cast if you'd come back.
Yeah,
I'd love to, guys. Look, this has been a lot of fun. The trip down memory lane, being associated with the two of you as players and coaches is certainly a highlight. In my career in the game, and that's what you love about the game is the friendships you make and the memories that you share. And if there's an opportunity and you'd love to like to have me come back, I'd be happy to.
I think that'd be perfect.
Yeah, I'd love that.
I think that'd be great because I learned some stuff today which I didn't know about you. I actually didn't know any of the baseball stuff. So I'm that's fantastic.
Yeah. I didn't realize it was 81. Like we were in U10.
It was 82.
That was a long time.
Hey, I got one question. Smitty, do you remember, were you with the national team in 92? Like back in, I just remember getting called out. I wasn't on the national team at that time. I was actually still playing, just coming out of junior and playing a year senior B out in the coast. And they called me at Christmas time and they said, hey, can you come out and pitch to, because the guys were preparing for, obviously it would have been for the 92 Worlds.
We're going to Manila, yeah.
Do you remember me out there? That you brought me out, and I was supposed to pitch BP, and I think I threw a total of about 50 pitches, and about 40 of them were about 35-foot drop balls. So I just remember Doug Chase, he actually gave, he shrugged his shoulders and put his hands up in the air like, are you even throwing to me? So that was my very first
Chase
experience.
Chase would have been animated,
so. Yeah. Yeah, I'm just like, oh my gosh! I guess my career's done.
Well, it was soon after that you developed a rise ball.
exactly.
Probably had to do it. Hey, speaking of 92, we would be remiss because maybe we can wrap it up here as far as the playing career and stuff. And I wanted to ask you, tell us about the at bat in 92, Smitty.
Geez, I was just going to get to that. I wanted to say for our listeners, can you remind us how that went and how and just explain that game, because I'm looking at a pretty big, bold, highlighted piece. Of an at-bat you had in the final of that tournament. So please, this is a great, great,
perfect, highlight. Perfect way to go.
You know, it's what's funny is that was my first ISF World Championship with Canada. There was two previous opportunities that when I could have had a chance to play and for various reasons didn't work out that I got to do it. So this was my one and only. I would have been 32, I think. And it's funny, we're playing in that gold medal game against the Kiwis and Mike Pietnik's on the mound and they jump out to a 3-0 lead. And I'm playing right field, and it's the first time in my life that I played on a national team where we were actually losing the gold medal game. Mm-hmm. We'd never been losing. We'd been tied lots of times. We'd never been losing. And, you know, the innings are starting to tick along, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, you think about all the sacrifice you make, and you've been in Manila for 2.5 weeks, and you can't eat the food, and you can't drink the water, like all of the stuff that goes with some of these trips that everybody else thinks are so glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And you're thinking, you know, the sacrifice you made all winter, the shape you needed to be in to go and play out of season. And those are some of the thoughts that were in my head. I was thinking, Jesus, for as hard as we worked and the time we've put in, and, you know, this can't be the outcome that we're going to have. And then, you know, sure enough, the couple of things happen in the fifth inning, and then Jody comes up and pinch hits and ties it up. And, okay, now we're back in it, and, you know, now what's going to happen? And I came up in the fifth inning, with a runner on second base, and Michael Waite struck me out on a full count changeup. And I remember thinking to myself at the time, like, I wasn't a very good guess hitter, but I remember thinking to myself, you know, he might throw me an off-speed pitch here because he'd been throwing down and in on the hands and doing what Whitey did so well. And you know, I was thinking it, but I wasn't committed to it. And, you know, he strikes me out to end the inning, and there's a runner on second. And, of course, what you take to the field now is, was that our chance to win? And, you know, what happens if we lose the game? And I had a chance, and all the things that we as players kind of live and die by. And then the eighth inning comes, and they got two outs. It was two outs right away, and then Clark Bosch hits a one-handed triple down the left field line. It was a changeup. Whitey threw him, and he get out in front, and he hits it by Sorensen down in the corner, and he's on third. And then Marty comes up, and they intentionally walk Marty. And I had been taken out of the game for defensive purposes. Steve Scott was playing in right field, and when they walked Marty to go first and third with two outs, then Terry put me back into my spot in the order.
Psych.
And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, of course, you know, like, he wouldn't dare throw me another changeup. Like, that's kind of what's going through my head. But I also knew Whitey well enough. He and I are same age. We'd come up through ISCs together. I knew him well enough to know I'm not going to get a strike to hit until he falls behind in the count. He's not going to throw me anything that's hittable. And he did exactly that. He went two balls down and away. And actually, the third pitch he threw was a ball, and they called it a strike. And then he came in on my hands with a rise ball. And, just knowing the kind of cat and mouse that Whitey played, I figured it was going to be a changeup or a rise ball, but he wasn't going to come back with another drop. And I figured rise ball just because I hadn't seen very many of them in my previous at-bats, and he would probably think I wouldn't be expecting it. And sure enough, he threw me another rise ball, and I hit it off the center field wall, and, you know, the rest was history. But it was, you know, I mean, Michael Whitey, a lot of people remember Michael, you know, later in his career when he was really more of an off-speed, you know, get you out in front, you know. But Whitey threw the ball hard, and he had a real bite to his drop ball, and he had a super changeup. And he was just one of those pitchers where for me anyway, I was better off not trying to guess what would come, because he never would be, whatever you thought was coming was what you didn't get. I found with him it was just about go up there and just look for a good hard strike and hope you're going to get one. And I was fortunate enough to, and things went our way. But it was a, you know, obviously the highlight of my life in terms of winning that event and getting the hit to win it. But we had a great team. I mean, Kettner came out of the ball game, and Jody Henniger went in for three innings, and he just stifled them. And then Terry Bell went in, and Terry had struggled throughout most of that tournament, and he came in there for three innings, and he just threw that hard
drop
ball that he throws, and they didn't do anything with it. And then Z came in, and that's really was Z's coming out party. He 91, he'd had a pretty good year, but that year at the Worlds, he really became the Darren Zach that went on for 5 or 6 years and was the best pitcher in the game. And you know, once we got through the game tied, we felt pretty good about being able to win it, but luckily things went our way.
Awesome. Very cool. Go Canada.
What a great story to end that cast on. That's an amazing, amazing accomplishment for you, for sure. And it wasn't off of me. Like, I didn't pitch that. It was Michael Whitey is a world class. You know, you weren't hitting off a BP thrower. So amazing. Mark, thanks again for coming on, and thank you again for agreeing. That's what we have now is a binding contract, because it's on the air, and you did say you'd come back.
That's right.
So I've got a couple witnesses. So I really appreciate your time. We'll set up another follow-up to do the other side of the game that we want to get over. But we always do at the end is we have parting shots. So last words, do you want to say anything to the listeners out there? Oh, we'll start with you, Mark. I know, Dean, I know. But you should know this is coming. So
I know.
You got a minute or so to prepare. Get ready. Mark, anything you want to have as a parting shot?
I appreciate the opportunity. When Keith and I were speaking the other day, and he told me about what you're doing, especially given this COVID-19 and just the general state of the world. I mean, what a great way to give you know, people who love our game an opportunity to, you know, to hear and share some stories and do a little bit of the remember and when that we got to do here in this last hour. And it's really appreciated. And I think for people who love our game, it's always interesting to hear, you know, sort of the intimate side of some of the stories they may know about, but now they kind of get the behind the scenes piece too, which is always fun.
Fantastic. Dino, what about you?
Very cool. Well, I was going to go dark and start cutting all you guys, but now I can't do that because Smitty was all up, you know, nice and stuff. But I think about, you know, you mentioned COVID-19 and, you know, we are where we are, and this is a strange place in history. And I know that the last hour that we've spent chatting here, I've kind of forgot about everything. So it's been really good for me because I got to tell you, I'm going squirrely here. I got to, you know, going a little nutty. So I really appreciated the time, Smitty, and I definitely look forward to our next chat too on the lady side of things.
Awesome. Thanks, buddy.
Perfect. Tosh?
Yeah, just kind of same sort of thing. Smitty, thanks for doing this. You know, it's awesome because when we first started doing this, we had a unique kind of look at things because we came from the guys' game. We talk about the girls' game. We talk about players we've, you know, been fortunate enough to help send to college and that sort of thing. So I'm really looking forward to the female chat because, as probably people know, or you've been a mentor to me. You got me into this coaching girls gig. So you know, I'm really interested in our conversation on part two.
Absolutely,
well, wonderful, buddy.
Perfect. Yep. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks for listening to Tuesday Talk with Tosh, Dino, and Donnie.